Greetings, this is James Stancil of the New Books Network's African American Studies channel. Today, I'm going to be talking with Thomas Aiello, a professor at Valdosta State University. His book, Battle for the Souls of Black Folk. Battle for the Souls of Black Folk. W.E.B. Du Bois, Booker T. Washington, and the Debate that Shaped the Course of Civil Rights. This is an outstanding book. It's 600 pages of documentation, great research, and great information about this important time in American history. So, enjoy yourself, sit back, listen, and listen to some great scholarship by a great scholar. Hello, this is James Stancil, and welcome back to the New Books Network and the African American Studies channel. Today, we have the pleasure of talking to a wonderful author, a Valdosta State University history professor, Dr. Thomas Aiello. And he's going to talk with us today about his book, The Battle for the Souls of Black Folks, W.E.B. Du Bois, Booker T. Washington, and the Debate that Shaped the Course of Civil Rights. Welcome, Dr. Thomas Aiello.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for taking the time with us today. And I just wanted to get you to talk about your book a little bit. Your book's brand new. When did it officially come out?
It came out this summer. So very recently.
All right. And it's on Prager. And it's a 500-page book, very well researched, very well done. And, you know, before we kind of get into your book, I would love for you to, if you don't mind, tell the audience a little bit about yourself and your background.
Sure. Well, I come from North Louisiana.
Okay.
A place where, much like South Georgia, where I live now, is a place that is beset by rural poverty and abject racism. But it's the kind of place that if you live there, you don't, and you're white, you don't see it. You don't notice it. You don't understand. And so when I left to go to college and got the chance to look back at my hometown from the distance of college, you kind of see the uglier parts of the town in which you were raised that you never really noticed because it was always the only thing you had ever known. And that kind of, you know, kind of led me into thinking more about Black history as a lived phenomenon in the South, especially. After college, I worked at the State Museum of Arkansas.
Okay.
For a while, before going to grad school and getting my PhD at the University of Arkansas in 2007. After that, I taught a little bit at the University of Louisiana in Lafayette, and then I came over here to Valdosta, where I'm part of the History Department and the African American Studies program, and been doing that ever since.
And here you are.
Here I am. That's right.
Where did you attend undergrad?
A small college called Henderson in Arkadelphia, Arkansas.
Wow.
Small college town, small liberal arts college in the middle of Arkansas. I am a Southerner. I have never really been outside of the South, you know, lived outside of the South. I stayed in Louisiana and Arkansas almost my entire life until I came over here to Georgia, so...
Okay. You're definitely an SEC man.
I am
right?
Very much an SEC man. The Hogs are undefeated so far this year, and let's knock on wood before we keep going to make sure that continues.
That sounds good to me. And I'm also a son of the South myself. North Carolina born and bred. Tar Heel born and bred, and when I die, I will be Tar Heel dead.
I understand that. I understand.
As we like to say. Were there any influential figures or mentors or anyone that really maybe influenced you in your academic career?
Oh, there are so many. You know, writing books for a living, you realize very soon once you start doing that kind of thing that it takes a bunch of people. It's not just a single phenomenon. It is a collaborative effort that one person happens to get their name on. And for all of the books,
absolutely.
For all the books that I have written, there have been so many people that have helped. Probably the most important academic mentor to me is a woman named Mary Farmer Kaiser, who is now the dean of the graduate school at the University of Louisiana, but who was the person who helped me when I started graduate school. When I went to graduate school, I did so not coming straight out of college, not assuming that I would ever do this for a living. It seemed very far-fetched at the time. And to have people kind of show you the way through what academia and writing is necessary. I mean, so many people who have the ability to kind of do this kind of stuff don't have that person who says, this is how this is done. And once you get the rules, it all turns out to be a lot easier than everybody assumes.
That's a great point, Tom. And, you know, we talked a little bit off air about my nonprofit work with Intellectuel Incorporated in the Houston area. And hopefully we can get you down to work with some of our students there. But exactly what you're talking about, people have the skill set and the ability, but they may not have that mentor or that push to help them get there.
You know, we call that demystification, where for a lot of students, college or beyond college or writing meaningful stuff seems hard because they don't understand the rules. But once they get in there and they actually see what it is, they say, oh, this isn't such a big deal. I can do this.
Right.
It's just a matter of having somebody kind of show them the rules. I mean, if you don't know the rules, football is just 22 guys running around on a patch of grass. I mean, you know,
that's a great point.
It starts to make sense. And I think that is – Mary did that for me, for sure.
Oh, awesome. So, yeah, well, maybe we'll have to make sure that we send her a copy of this podcast, right? I'll let her know.
Absolutely.
So she can know that young Tom did good.
She still gets reminded of that. I still make sure she knows every once in a while.
That's awesome. Would you like to give a shout-out to any of your students, present or past, Valdosta State, or any of your other stops?
Absolutely. No, my students have been absolutely wonderful, and actually – I've had a graduate research assistant help that has helped with some of my more recent stuff, including this. Jenny Smith, who is now a doctoral candidate up at Notre Dame, was a master's student here who did a lot of work for me and has helped made tracking down a lot of the more obscure stuff, especially in the battle for the souls of Black folk, a lot easier.
Right.
Again, I mean, these things really are a collaborative effort.
Absolutely. And, you know, sometimes I'm glad you mentioned that, too, Tom, because sometimes people don't understand that they see your name on the cover and they don't understand all the people that it took to get there.
So many, you know, the book publishing process is about 18 different layers before you get from manuscript to book. And there are so many people that help along the way, too many to name. But certainly these things are group efforts, to be sure.
All right. So Jenny Smith up there,
Jenny Smith,
Dr. Aiello, he did not forget you. So he gave you a shout out in his podcast.
He still doesn't like Notre Dame, Jenny. He still doesn't like Notre Dame.
So, you know, speaking of your most recent book, The Battles for the Souls of Black Folk. Can you just, you know, maybe tell our listeners a little bit about what was your influence? What made you decide to write on this specific topic at this time?
Well, the debate that happens between Du Bois and Booker Washington is so important and so seminal to how the narrative of Black intellectual history progresses in the 20th century. And yet, when people talk about their relationship, it's almost always ancillary to something else. It is a small part of a biography of Du Bois or Washington, or it is a debate that talks about Du Bois's frustration with Tuskegee, or it comes in the context of the NAACP. It's very rare that you have that conversation that they have, a sustained 20-year conversation between two of the most important intellectual figures at the turn of the century, given pride of place, and have it be kind of the dominant part of the narrative, and just kind of have that conversation be the subject rather than kind of something that is akin to the subject. And so the idea was to kind of flesh out their debate and see kind of how it projects backwards and forwards into the narrative of black rights and how leaders have discussed black rights, frankly, from the antebellum era all the way till today.
Okay. Well, I think you definitely accomplish your goal. This is an outstanding text, and I think it's, and you are welcome. And I think it will be used as a reference for years to come. And, you know, we talked a little offline about U.S. history classes, specifically like advanced placement U.S. history classes, where they talk just briefly about Du Bois and Washington. And maybe, you know, with your text here, that conversation can get a little more deep, you know, in those K-12 classes.
I would like that. You know, as someone who teaches African-American studies, I am every semester I am surprised by the number of people who aren't very familiar with they're familiar with the names, I think, of Du Bois and Washington, but as far as their positions, their stances, kind of what they stood for and how they were very different, they don't really understand that. I mean, most people lump them together because they were black leaders at the turn of the century. Not knowing that they were completely antithetical to one another, did not like one another, that, you know, we always kind of make the claim that Africa is a country, right? That people talk about Africa, they just group it all together because it's easier for them to think of it as one place instead of a myriad of places, which it actually is. I think that's what we do in kind of debates about black philosophy, black activism, those kind of things where black leaders really debate each other and do not have the same positions, but because they're black thinkers, history often kind of lumps them together, which is something that would never do for white thinkers of the time. And kind of drawing the distinctions between some of the black thinkers who, I mean, these guys, Du Bois and Washington, were so much more nuanced than they usually get credit for. They hated each other and actively campaigned against each other's ideas. I think it helps a lot of students to know that there isn't historical civil rights position. There are actually a bunch of them, and not all of them agree. And all of them have very different ways of doing things or different ideas about how to get things done. And I think we're better off understanding the nuances of those debates and realizing that it's okay to disagree with commonly held positions. We've been doing it since time immemorial.
Wow. Great points. And I think that your book is definitely going to be a great addition to the academy and to, you know, public thought about these issues.
Thank you.
And so, again, you know, I wanted to personally thank you for this. You know, Du Bois has been, you know, one of my inspirations for my academic work for years. And, you know, when I saw your book here, you know, as I mentioned to you before offline, I was excited to have the opportunity to talk with you and share your research and your work with the general audience. And again, the book that we're talking about on this podcast is The Battle for the Souls of Black Folk: W.E.B. Du Bois, Booker T. Washington, and the Debate that Shaped the Course of Civil Rights, by Valdosta State University Professor Thomas Aiello. He's taken a few minutes to talk with us here today about his work and his research and his most recent book that came out this summer. And I highly recommend it. Definitely check it out if you get a chance. It's 500 pages of outstanding scholarship, primary sources, good research being done by this African-American studies scholar and history professor. The Battle for the Souls of Black Folks, Dr. Thomas Aiello, Valdosta State University. And so if you don't mind, sir, maybe we can get into, you know, more specifics if you want to hit some of the key points or key things there that you could share with the audience that they can look for when they read your book.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, well, there definitely is an arc to the story. You know, and though Du Bois and Washington do have histories before they come into contact with one another, in reality, this story starts in 1895. You know, I always think that 1895 is one of the seminal years for the development of black thought in the 20th century. In February of 1895, Frederick Douglass dies. And he had been the unquestioned kind of fount of knowledge for Black America. Yes. He was the guy that could get an audience with anybody in the country anytime he wanted. And when he dies, there is this real power vacuum at the top of that leadership position, and a lot of people are going to buy for it. It is also in 1895 when a young W.E.B. Du Bois gets his Ph.D. from Harvard, becoming the first Black man to earn a Ph.D. in history. Even though we know him as a sociologist, his Ph.D., there wasn't a discipline for sociology.
Sure.
So he actually got his Ph.D. in history. And it is that very same year, in 1895, uncoincidentally, that Booker Washington goes to the Cotton States Exposition in Atlanta and mm-hmm. gives the speech that's going to end up making him famous. Washington was very much a social climber. He had grown up, born into slavery, very famously, attended Hampton, and became a very devoted follower of the notion of industrial education, the kind of education that was being provided at Hampton, that learning was practical, not theoretical.
Right.
We do not need the liberal arts, or if we do, we need them as secondary to job training and the kinds of things that are going to create an economic infrastructure for
Black people. Right.
He ends up leaving Hampton and creating Tuskegee, and while that does very much make waves from Virginia to Alabama, he doesn't still have a national platform. It is going to be in 1895, after Frederick Douglass dies, and as Du Bois is defending his dissertation, that Washington stands up and gives a speech that we know as the Atlanta Compromise,
right.
in which he accepts segregation as a temporary accommodation, and in return wants this kind of white structural support for Black education and social uplift and some economic concessions and things like that. That makes him a celebrity throughout the country. This is just the kind of activism that white Southerners want to hear.
Sure.
And so,
yes.
And so he will become very well known in all communities because of that speech. And as a matter of fact, after he gives it, the young Du Bois writes him a note congratulating him on that speech.
Wow.
He says, "Dr. Washington, I just want to say congratulations. It was a message well sent." Of course, for the rest of his life, he will hate that speech. But as a grad student, and that might just be because grad students suck up to professors.
I was just thinking the same thing.
You know, that does very much happen. So that
might yes, be, it does.
He actually originally kind of likes it. But relatively soon, we start to see a change where Du Bois decides that that is not the way to go. Du Bois, of course, has a very different background. Du Bois grows up in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. He grows up in a largely white community. While he does experience some racism, he does not experience the kind of overt, ugly racism that people like Washington live with from day one. He is solidly middle class. His life is not reflective of what a Black Southerner's life was in the 19th century.
Okay.
And he has opportunities that simply others do not. He ends up going down to Fisk and doing well there, going back to Harvard. He does grad work in Germany, comes back and gets a PhD. This is not the typical Black experience. And so these two guys, he's also, by the way, 12 years younger than Booker Washington.
Okay.
There's an age gap. There is an education gap. There is a North-South gap. There is a class gap. These guys are kind of built to think differently.
Mm-hmm.
And they are going to start doing that. The real break that comes between them, we can really start to see it happen initially in 1898, three years after that initial speech that makes Washington famous. Both of these guys are on the board of a private school in Alabama called Coaliga.
Okay.
It is a secondary school. Of course, Alabama is not providing funding for Black public schools. And so, you know, these kind of private charitable organizations are the best way to get rural Black Alabamans a chance to go to school.
Okay.
But this guy who is running it is a friend of Du Bois. and believes very much in this new sociological model that Du Bois is putting out, which says segregation is not okay under any circumstances, and that the best position for black activists to have is that we need to push back against these kinds of things that relegate us to inferior positions.
Mm-hmm.
And because that guy became a friend of Du Bois, Washington drops out of the school.
Wow.
Gets rid of his funding and doesn't help. And in Alabama, that matters because Tuskegee is it in Alabama.
Right.
While Alabama State has been founded, Alabama State is not what it is going to become. And when you think about black education in Alabama, I mean, it is Alabama A&M, which is kind of out of the way, and it is the two schools near Montgomery, Tuskegee, which is outside of town, and Alabama State. And if Washington drops you in Alabama, you're not going to matter anymore. I mean, he is the kingmaker in Alabama. And so there really is a consequence there, and it comes largely because of this rift with Du Bois. The larger public won't see that until a little bit later. And most famously, it will come in the book that ends up being part of this book's title, Du Bois' The Souls of Black Folk.
Yes,
probably the most important early 20th century treatise on the black condition. What's interesting about that book is that Du Bois publishes it in 1903, but it's actually just a collection of his essays over the previous few years that he published in The Atlantic.
Okay.
And except for one. And the one that he adds to that collection to make it into a book is an essay called Of Mr. Booker T. Washington and Others, which is essentially just 20 pages of bashing Tuskegee, of bashing Washington, of bashing everything he stands for. And doing so in a book that becomes the first, you know, black bestseller of the 20th century. I mean, you know, a book that everyone reads. These were essays that were published in The Atlantic. And Du Bois, even though he does not have the stature of Washington yet, he's going to end up taking over for Washington. But even though he doesn't have that yet, he's still known. And that book is selling both to black and white audiences. And here we have a treatise on why Booker T. Washington is destroying the world. And his argument essentially is that we live in a time where in the 1890s alone, this country averaged over 180 lynchings per year. Between 1900 and 1914, there are going to be more than 1,000 more lynchings. And a lot of that is backed up by the academy, by universities. They are practicing various forms of pseudoscience that we tend to call social Darwinism or phrenology or all those kind of things. These complete pseudoscience, not true at all, but that argue that white people are genetically superior to everyone else. And even though it's not true, that doesn't really matter. I mean, even today, all the time, we will drive down the street and we will hear the radio say something like, a new discovery has been made in the journal Science, and we'll say, oh, wow, that's great. But none of us go to the library, find the journal, read it, and decide whether or not we actually believe it.
That's a great point.
We don't do that, because if it comes out of the academy, we just accept it as true.
We just accept
it. And so Du Bois' argument here is that, listen, even if people aren't atavistic Klan member racists, they're still going to have these racist assumptions because the academy is kind of teaching them these things, and so they're going to assume it to be true. It's not their fault. It's just the way that they're conditioned. If that is true, he says, then all black leaders have to denounce this kind of compromise that makes us into second-class citizens. Because if you have a black president of a prestigious, quote-unquote, Southern university like Tuskegee, kind of making claims that acknowledge or admit to some kind of black inferiority, then what we are doing is not building up an economic base. We are playing into the hands of those who are trying to describe us as lesser than.
Okay.
And so we have to stop that.
Mm-hmm.
That, of course, will only alienate Booker Washington, who's industrial education at Tuskegee is fine and that it is good and that he likes being famous. And so from there, the rift will grow to the point where they will actually try to have summits at Carnegie Hall. There will be a very famous summit between the Du Bois camp and the Tuskegee camp where they try to hash out a compromise so that they won't hate each other. And it totally fails. Du Bois walks out and refuses to even be there. Because, of course, the reason they're able to have it there is because Washington has cultivated friends like Andrew Carnegie.
Sure.
The white people. I mean, that is kind of his bailiwick. And Du Bois resents that as well, that he gets this kind of white funding that Du Bois could never get. At this point, though, Du Bois is often pilloried by a lot of Washington's followers as an unknowledgeable northerner. He has been living in Atlanta for years. He has essentially founded Atlanta's School of Social Work. And so even though he is a northerner, he does have this southern experience. This debate is happening relatively close to home. Atlanta and Montgomery are not that far away. And so this debate kind of has resonance for the black population, especially the black population that has not yet left on the Great Migration and that is just sitting there in the South imbibing these messages from these two leaders kind of very much in their midst. These two brilliant minds were just kind of going at it.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, that debate will get enlarged because Du Bois will decide that the Academy isn't doing enough to fight for the things he believes in, and so he will start to create rights organizations. In 1905, he creates Niagara, which itself, Niagara is specifically a snub of Washington. He invites what he calls the 28 most important black leaders in the country to Niagara Falls to have this meeting. And of course, none of Washington nor any of his people are invited.
Wow.
And that was kind of the whole idea. And of course, the reason Niagara fails is partly because it is an all-black movement trying to convince a group of white racists to be nice. That doesn't seem to work. But the other reason is because Washington openly sabotages it. Washington will send spies to Niagara meetings. He will put advertisements in newspapers denouncing Niagara. He cultivates editors of black newspapers and will refuse to advertise Tuskegee in those newspapers if they report favorably on Niagara. Mm-hmm. He very much takes a hand in trying to destroy it. And so Du Bois is forced to try again, this time with a bunch of kind of pseudo-abolitionists, these children and grandchildren of the white liberal elite of the 19th century who want to help. Mm-hmm. And they ultimately, of course, in 1909, the year after Niagara Falls, Niagara fails, create the NAACP.
Right.
An almost entirely white organization in its first incarnation.
And Jewish.
Absolutely. And what's interesting about that is that most of the board of directors of the original NAACP, of course, Du Bois, the only black member of the board of directors of the NAACP at first, they had to be coached by Du Bois on the differences between the two leaders. They just assumed,
wow,
you know, that they could support Washington too. And Du Bois was very clear, you can't really do that. We have, just because we're both black and we give speeches, doesn't mean we are alike.
We're not all the same.
Exactly. And so there had to be a lot of kind of makeup work done by the NAACP to kind of understand that they try early on to be an organization that does not take sides in that debate.
Okay.
But they find that that is going to be impossible. And eventually, peacemaking between the Tuskegee camp and the NAACP camp will fail. Washington will do his best to destroy the NAACP as well. He will actually Washington will actually send notes in his lesser moments. He will actually send notes to the editors of white newspapers in various towns where NAACP meetings will be held, so that they can put it in the paper in the hopes that white supremacists will come and break up those meetings.
Oh, my goodness.
And that is the level of vitriol that exists there. If any of our listeners kind of study lynchings in this country,
right,
they might be familiar that there are two lynching statistic bureaus that we have. The NAACP always kept kind of very detailed records on every lynching that they could find because papers weren't reporting on them. So did Tuskegee. And there are two lynchings.
Okay.
And they often have different numbers for each year. But the reason why they each do independent kind of studies is because there was Tuskegee and there was the NAACP and
the conflict
shall meet. I mean, it was very much
amazing.
This kind of legacy that we don't trust your numbers and you're not going to trust our numbers. And so we're going to have different numbers, even though they're clearly working to stop the same kinds of things. They're just doing so in two very different philosophically oriented ways that don't really, you know, don't necessarily connect. Ultimately,
that's amazing.
You know, the debate stops when one of the voices goes away, and Booker T. Washington will die in 1915. And when he dies, while Tuskegee continues on and still remains throughout the 20th century a kind of beacon of what Black Southern education is and can be, and does end up taking on far more liberal arts in the years to come.
Okay.
Washington suffers from the fact that when he's dead, Du Bois gets to control the message. He's the one who's alive. Remember, we don't often think of it, but W.E.B. Du Bois lives into the 1960s.
Right.
I mean, he lives for a very long time. And never in his life, he goes through a lot of phases. I mean, he will go through a very interesting phase where he writes poetry and fiction. He will go through a communist phase. He will end up rejecting the United States, and he will go live in Kwame Nkrumah's Ghana and die in Ghana. He will not even die in the United States because he is so captivated by Kwame Nkrumah and the New African Independence Movement. But through all of those different phases that he has later in his life, from 1915 to the 1960s, He never dropped his bitterness at Booker T. Washington. And so every few years, there's always a new essay from Du Bois that comes out that just wants to remind people that he was right and Washington was wrong. And so he gets to shape a legacy. And I think what it does for us today, without kind of really understanding this, is that we get these two caricatures of people. We see Du Bois as this uppity northerner with a silver spoon in his mouth that doesn't really understand the Black Southern experience and looks his nose down on what it's like to be Black and Southern. And then on the other side, we have this caricature of Booker T. Washington as this Uncle Tom who gives in to white demands and belittles Black education by making it industrial and not thinking that that Black students can major in philosophy and things like that. Mm-hmm. Both of those caricatures are wrong. Both of these guys cared about Black rights. They just had two very different ways of doing things. Du Bois lived in the South for 20 years. He understood the Black South. And to say he didn't is wrong. Washington cared about the Black South. And to say that he just capitulated to whites at every turn is also wrong.
Right.
His argument was that being a Southerner, being a slave, growing up at least early in his life, for the first few years of his life, as a slave, he understood that there were only certain messages that Southern white people would listen to. And so he chose to pick his battles based on the kind of fights he thought he could win. Du Bois went a different way. He said, no, we cannot compromise. We have to go at this full bore. I think the important thing to take from that debate is that neither side was necessarily wrong. They were just very antithetical to one another.
Mm-hmm.
But what that ends up doing is setting the bifurcated tracks of black rights thinking for the rest of the 20th century.
We see
a very clear line of those activists who make the case that we do not want segregation, we do not want job discrimination, we do not want voting discrimination, and that we are going to go out and do whatever it takes to get there. And there are that other side. Well, actually, here's the interesting part about that. I would actually argue otherwise. I would actually argue that Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam and the resulting Black Power movement, what we see Huey in Oakland and we see Fred Hampton in Chicago, we see the Panthers, we see those kind of groups. I would actually argue that they are in the tradition of Booker Washington, that they are making the case that what Black America needs is not integration, is that it is a Black economic infrastructure that creates a system whereby the Black population can be equal without depending on white people. Mm-hmm. That we can do this ourselves. And the reason we haven't been able to is because all of our Black traditions are eroded through integration. Mm-hmm. The great example I like to use is if you take a packet of sugar and you put it in water, you have sugar and water, but you only see the water. The sugar dissolves.
Mm.
Whenever you have one culture that is dominant, that controls everything, when integration happens, this is the argument that Huey Newton made, it subsumes the lesser community into it. The smaller population that doesn't have the kind of political power is going to go away. And so integration means act like white people, be more like white people, come to white education. And so because of that, Black Power advocates argued that we don't want integration. We want to nurture our values.
Okay.
We want to create separate economic enclaves that create powerful Black communities that don't need a white infrastructure to work. And to be honest with you, that's pretty much the same kind of thing that Booker Washington was saying.
Okay.
But if you say it in rural Alabama, it sounds like an Uncle Tom. If you say it in Harlem, it sounds like radical.
Very interesting.
Du Bois is kind of the lead-in to someone like, say, Martin Luther King, who makes uncompromising stands against segregation, for integration, who fights for voting rights, and who does so through protest channels, and who makes himself a known commodity academically and publicly. And so I do think those corollaries continue on, but I actually think that it goes – we can draw our line from Washington to Black Power and from Du Bois to the first wave civil rights movement of SCLC. People like that. I think that's probably the easiest way to kind of understand how that develops.
I'm glad you took the time to explain that. Because that may be
it seems maybe counterintuitive, but
right. But it makes sense. And I don't want to take up too much of your time here, Dr. Aiello.
Sure.
Can you hear me?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yes. I don't want to take up too much of your time here, Dr. Aiello. I know that you've got classes to teach and research to conduct, but I did want to ask you, additionally before we close. What type of current research or future research are you interested in or are you going to be involved with?
Over the summer, I just finished a manuscript on the Black press in the South, in particular, in the generation before the Civil Rights Movement. That's the next big project, kind of understanding Black newspapers in the South right before the Civil Rights Movement. Black newspapers often get pilloried as being far more conservative than papers like The Defender or The Courier or The Amsterdam News. And so I think by understanding what Black newspapers were saying in the 30s and 40s, right before first wave civil rights begins after World War II, we can understand what the adults of the 1940s grew up understanding with Black newspapers in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, so that we can get a better idea of what the civil rights mind looked like by understanding what the press was doing not in the North, but here in the South, where the vast majority of the black population lived.
Mm-hmm.
All those stories about Pullman porters carrying down Chicago defenders and Pittsburgh couriers down to black
readers,
that's true, that happened, but they were always supplements to papers like the Atlanta Daily World, or where you are, the Houston Informer. You know, papers mm-hmm. like that that were so important to those local communities. The reason we don't talk about them very much is because since white people in the South control all the libraries and everything else, we just don't have as many of them as we do the defense. They weren't saved in the same way that some of those Northern papers were. So I have spent actually years upon years tracking down as many of those black Southern newspapers as mm-hmm. I possibly could to try to get an idea of what they were saying and how they kind of informed black thinking in that generation before civil rights.
Okay. Well, I would love to get you back when you complete that project so we can talk about that one as well. That sounds very interesting. I think our listeners would love to hear about that. And just to make sure that we give your book the plug that it needs, The Battle for the Souls of Black Folk, W.E.B. Du Bois, Booker T. Washington, and the Debate That Shaped the Course of Civil Rights by Dr. Thomas Aiello of Valdosta State University. This is a great book, very well researched, very well documented. And if you heard Dr. Aiello here, you know that he knows his stuff on this topic. So I greatly recommend you check out this book and some of his other works as well. I mean, he's a noted African-American history scholar. So, Dr. Aiello, I'm not going to take up too much more of your time today. Thank you so much for taking a few moments or a few minutes with us to let us know about your book, and hopefully our listeners will go out there and pick it up. It's a great book. It's an outstanding cover. If you get a chance to look at that cover, you're going to want to buy the book. It's a very beautiful cover. All right. So we're going to end it here. Thank you, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, and hopefully you'll come through Houston and we can sit down and chat a little bit about some of the local politics and local history.
I would love it.
All right. Take care, sir, and thank you all for listening to the New Books Network, our African American Studies channel, and we will see you next time.
Okay, I hope you enjoyed the interview today with Thomas Aiello of Valdosta State University. His book, The Battle for the Souls of Black Folk, W.E.B. Du Bois, Booker T. Washington, and the Debate That Shaped the Course of Civil Rights. We'll see you next time on the African American Studies channel of the New Books Network. This is James Stancil. Have a great day.